The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Today, we're looking into how math can be both expertly and inexpertly applied as evidence for crimes in local criminal justice systems and on an international scale. A little later, we'll talk to Dr. Patrick Ball, Executive Director of the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, about his work exposing human rights crimes in war-torn countries around the world. But first, I'm here with Dr. Leila Schneps, a mathematician and co-author of the book Math on Trial: How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. She studied mathematics at Harvard University, has taught mathematics for nearly 30 years, and now holds a research position at the University of Paris in France. She belongs to the Bayes in Law Research Consortium, an international team devoted to improving the use of probability and statistics in criminal trials. Welcome to the show, Leila.
Hi, nice to meet you.
What was the inspiration for Math on Trial? What first brought these issues to your attention?
Actually, we were always, my daughter studied math like I did, and it was our interest. And we were always very sensitive to all kinds of mathematical problems that would come up in the newspapers. And we wanted to write a book about some of these problems, and we realized the subject is just too vast. And at one point, we thought we really have to focus on one specific thing, and it has to be something very important, not some trivial thing that nobody worries about. And some of these problems, a couple of the chapters in our book were actually cases that came to our attention through the newspaper, and that's how we chose.
Now, the book is actually a series of sort of in-depth case studies of real cases, both in the past and actually in the not distant past. Some are fairly recent and still in the news today, that are used to illustrate some of these problematic mathematics. Why did you decide to structure the book kind of on a case study by case study example?
We wanted to really make the point that math turns up unexpectedly, but still quite frequently, in natural ways in real life. We didn't just want to illustrate a mathematical concept by artificially bringing in some story to illustrate it. We wanted to show that the math comes up in the real story. And so for this reason, we wanted to tell the whole story of each case, including all the parts that don't have math in them.
So really showing that this isn't sort of some abstract theoretical problem.
Yeah, and math can just turn up in somebody's life in a really important way. That's what we wanted to illustrate.
So let's just dive in. Can you tell us about the case of Sally Clark?
This was a case that happened in not that long ago, about 10 years ago. And it was a woman whose baby died, and she had a second baby. And the second baby died, and they called the ambulance, and the babies were rushed to hospital. These were very small, near newborn children, and the doctors couldn't save them. And autopsy could not figure out why they died. And she was very unlucky, because right around that same time, there was a doctor in England, this happened in England, who was making a career on studying child abuse and detecting child abuse and accusing mothers of child abuse. And of course, everybody knows that. It's very, very hard when you see a child with an injury or a bump or something, whether the child really has just fallen down or whether it's child abuse. And I mean, this doctor was doing a very important work. But what happened is he got carried away in the accusing of mothers, and he started to testify at a lot of trials. And Sally Clark was one of them. And he testified that because the doctors couldn't find a cause of death for these children, well, there's a phenomenon called crib death, which is just, babies die suddenly and nobody knows why.
Right.
And it does happen. This is well known. But here he said, well, this is a case of two babies in one family dying this way. And he said the probability of a crib death in a family like hers is 1 in 8,000. And so for two children, it would be 1 in 8,000 squared, which is 1 in many millions. And it's too small a probability. It can't have been that way. She must have murdered them. And this was his testimony in court, which he gave with some extremely unpleasant analogies, such as to tell you how small the probability is that this could have happened naturally. You have to think of betting on the horse that wins the Grand National 4 years in a row. The figures he gave seemed to have a great influence. Everybody, the jury, the judge, and the whole country believed that she had murdered her two children and she went to prison. And only a few people just kept on fighting for her and saying, this is ridiculous, outrageous. Of course she didn't kill these children. And finally, some records were dug up from the hospital and from the autopsy, and it was realized that there were medical causes for the deaths that doctors simply hadn't completely observed or understood. And so she was released from prison after many unsuccessful appeals. And part of the reason that she was released was also because the Royal Statistical Society of England fought for her, because they realized that this calculation was wrong.
It sounds like sort of the only point of evidence in this trial was suspicion and some probability calculations. Is that correct?
That's right. The trouble is, when you have an unexplained crib death, there is no evidence. In this case, actually, there was evidence that the doctors missed because one of the children had a bad infection. But other than that, I mean, that was evidence in her favor. There was no evidence against her whatsoever. There was slight bruising of the chest, but since the father of the baby, the second baby, had really attempted resuscitation, which he had been taught, mm-hmm. this could very well just follow from the pressure that you put on a baby's chest during resuscitation, and that's what it was.
So what was the actual math issue in here? What was wrong with the calculation?
So what's wrong with the calculation is, he started with a statistics that was perfectly reasonable, which was, there are well-known statistics about crib death. In families of a given social class, so she was a lawyer, well off, you know, highly educated, crib death will occur about, like you said, about one time in 8,000. It's much more common if you look at the whole population. It's about one case in them, about 1,300. But okay, in her social class, it's rarer. But the thing is, already just the point of observing that it's dependent, that the statistic changes in different social classes, shows you that it is not a purely random incident, right?
Right.
And he multiplied the probability, he squared it. He multiplied the probability by itself as though this is a purely random incident. And he ignored all the indications that even come from the very statistics he was citing, that it's not purely random, that it is caused by just unknown factors. And apart from conditions depending on various social classes, such as poverty, there's also genetic factors that can explain these things that are simply not understood. And he ignored all of that, which can very well mean that these things can run in families.
Right. So basically, the multiplying of the probabilities created this astronomical figure that wasn't accurate.
Exactly. It's the contrary of astronomical. It's really microscopically small, the probability that it could have happened naturally. The real error was to multiply these two probabilities that nothing tells us that are independent. And in fact, everything sort of indicates that they are non-independent, and it's not just a random thing.
How often does this misuse crop up in criminal court cases? I mean, in your book itself, it crops up a few times.
Well, it crops up fairly frequently. But the thing is that there have been these court cases. We do have several of them in the book. I think we have at least three, it's not difficult to understand what the mistake is. So people have understood it now, and it's crept into the awareness of the legal system, and they're very much on guard against it. So that particular mistake is something that hasn't actually happened to my knowledge recently.
So some of this stuff is getting corrected as precedents are set and court cases are corrected.
Absolutely, and I have hopes. I mean, there aren't a million errors you can make. I mean, they do tend to be of certain very specific types, the kind that will concern issues that do come up at trial. And I think it would be possible to hope that someday they will all be, I mean, lawyers and judges and even the general public who form the juries will be educated on these basic facts and will be able to avoid them.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, where we're discussing the use and sometimes misuse of probability, statistics, and estimation in criminal court cases with Dr. Leila Schneps, author of Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. So in the book, you also talk about unjustified estimates. These crop up in the case of Janet and Malcolm Collins. What happened there?
Right. In unjustified estimates, those happen a lot. So the previous case we just talked about, Sally Clark, the doctor did start from a correctly determined statistic, which had been found by a study on the subject. But sometimes such a study or a database with the correct statistics doesn't exist. And what happens is that a lawyer will tend to make an estimation of what he thinks the proper statistic is. And the thing is, you may be in the ballpark when you make a guess like that. You may say something that's reasonable. But if you do this on two or three or four different topics and then multiply them, then you will be way, way off base because you keep hugely increasing the error every time you multiply them.
So give us a little background. What actually happened in this case?
Back in the 1960s, an elderly woman was knocked down in the street. Her bag was stolen, which contained some money. And the woman barely got a glimpse of the thief, who was a girl with a blonde ponytail running quickly away. And a neighbor standing in his garden also saw this girl with a blonde ponytail running away. And he saw her leap into a yellow car driven by a black man and drive off. And since no one had any idea who these people were, what police did is simply look all over the neighborhood to see if they could find a mixed race couple, which was something that in the early 1960s in Los Angeles, well, this was something that was both rare and something that the people would be talking about and possibly disapproving.
Right.
So they would already be under suspicion just for being what they were. And they did find a couple. And this couple had a yellow car. But they couldn't find any evidence against the couple at all. They had a kind of alibi. The girl had left work about 5 minutes before the robbery. But on the other hand, the robbery was pretty nearby where she worked. So it could be, but there was no real proof. A friend remembered their coming over, but she couldn't remember exactly what time. They didn't have a proper alibi, but no one could prove that they had done this robbery. And neither of the witnesses could identify the girl. Both of them said, I just don't know if it was her or not. One of them said, I remember her hair being lighter than that. And the other one said, I remember her hair being darker than that. You know, eyewitnesses, it's not very reliable.
Right.
So neither of the witnesses would actually identify them. And they also arrested the couple two or three times and questioned them very intensively, and they couldn't get an admission either. And they kept having to let them go and try to get more information and arrest them again. And finally, they put them on trial, and there was still no proof. And so the lawyer, the prosecuting lawyer, came up with this idea of trying to calculate the probability that it could be any other couple, that there could be any other couple in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles area, who had the blonde ponytail, the beard, and the yellow car. He just invented probabilities. So he said, okay, let's say one woman in 10 has a ponytail. I can't remember exact numbers, but, you know, he said one guy in 10 has a beard, one guy in 5 has a mustache, one person in 10 has a yellow car, and he multiplied all these numbers together. In fact, he called a mathematician to the stand and made him multiply the numbers together. But he didn't let the mathematician speak. And the mathematician later said in an interview that, you know, he knew these probabilities were not necessarily independent. But he was given no chance to say. He was told to multiply, so he multiplied. And, of course, they're not independent. I mean, a man with a mustache and a man with a beard, these are not independent features, right? There's a lot of overlap there.
Right.
And to calculate the probability that a woman will have a ponytail just doesn't make any sense, because she can have a ponytail and then not have it 1 minute later. So he just pulled the numbers out of the air. Of course, each one of them may not have been utterly unreasonable. But when he multiplied them, he got an outrageously small probability that there could be some other couple having all those features in the Los Angeles area, like one in billions. And basically his reasoning was, so this must be the couple.
So what was the actual outcome of this trial? Were they convicted on this kind of random guesswork?
They were convicted. They went to prison. The woman, they were married. The woman didn't appeal because she got a one-year sentence. And so she just kept her head down and worked it out. But he got a much bigger sentence, and he appealed. And he found a lawyer who understood that there had been an error in the math. But the funny thing is that even the defense lawyer who was appealing, even though he really put his finger on what the mistake was, he explained it in this really funny way. He said, these probabilities are not independent. For instance, it's not independent that a blonde woman would have a black husband, because blondes are so adventurous. And he said the same thing about a yellow car. He said, you know, black people, they love yellow cars. And he made all these outrageous statements with full of stereotypes. And so they were convicted again at appeal. And it went up to the Supreme Court. And at the Supreme Court, there was a clerk clerking for the judge of the Supreme Court in California. And this clerk happened to have been a mathematics undergrad at Harvard, very brilliant. And in fact, he's a very famous person now. His name is Lawrence Tribe. He's a professor at Harvard Law School. He was an advisor to President Obama. But at the time, he was just a law clerk. But he completely understood all the errors. And he wrote this brilliant brief, which is anonymous. I only found out much later that he's the person who authored this. It appears as an appendix to the Supreme Court judgment, and it completely sets out all the mistakes very well. And the judgment was reversed by the Supreme Court.
Wow. So obviously, juries are made up of lay people who don't necessarily have the background to be able to spot bad estimation, or perhaps they just take the prosecution at their word.
Juries tend to take mathematics very seriously and sort of believe in its power. That's something that Lawrence Tribe expressed after this experience, in this case and other cases, is a great danger. Using math in trial, the real danger is that people are sort of respectful of the mathematical formulas, and so they don't dare question them, and so they accept them, and this leads to big errors.
Now, this case happened in the 60s. Are we still seeing cases of poor estimation here? Do people actually have to justify their estimates when used in a court case?
We are still seeing cases of poor estimates, but they're much more subtle than they used to be. No, I don't think people nowadays would dare just pull numbers out of their hat. But there's a lot of things going on about databases being used, and then the opposing lawyer will challenge the database. You know, this database isn't broad enough. It doesn't contain enough to really give information about the real situation. And there was a case like this in England recently, very serious case, where it was about identifying a shoe print from, I think it was a Nike or Adidas shoe. I don't know exactly. But anyway, in order to identify with a partial shoe print, they used a database of shoe prints. And the database was eventually judged just not to be sufficiently good to do the calculation that they did. And the judge overturned the conviction of this person accused of murder. And the judge actually ruled that you cannot use this kind of mathematics at all in trials unless you are basing them on very, very solid statistics.
So is this more a problem of lawyers not understanding the math or juries not understanding the math?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But both things happen. So in our book, we mainly dealt with cases of lawyers not understanding the math. We're kind of ruminating over a second book now, which would be the cases where lawyers are understood or else called expert witnesses who explain the math very well, and the juries didn't understand it, or sometimes the judge didn't understand it. And so you have these cases where convictions that are obviously correct are overturned because the judge will rule that you cannot use this level of mathematics in a trial because you're going beyond what the jury can understand and you're encroaching on their province by basically telling them what to do and how to calculate.
I see. So there's this worry, I guess, that if the math is so sort of abstract but seems so obvious at the end or seems to very clearly point to someone, that the jury won't understand but they'll just go with the math?
It's difficult because the jury has got to believe an expert witness. This happens not only in math, right? This happens in all kinds of things.
Right.
But the jury has got to believe an expert witness, and sometimes it has happened recently that when the expert witness, I don't know why, judges will accept what expert witnesses say about biological things and all kinds of things, but when it comes to pure math, there have been cases where judges have not accepted that the case be judged on math.
That's really interesting that math has kind of got this weird, not kind of special denotation, but it seems to confuse people more than other things.
It does, it does. And there's another question that's been asked quite frequently recently, which is, it can happen that a statistics expert will contradict a DNA expert on the interpretation of some DNA results, because there's two parts when you analyze DNA. There's a part where you run it through the machines and you have to absolutely know how to extract it and treat it and, you know, get a result. And the result looks like a sort of a graph.
Right.
But once you've got the graph, the DNA experts have rules about how to interpret it. But there are a lot of statisticians that say those rules are not really subtle enough to do the difficult cases, the cases where you've got a mixed DNA sample of many people, things like that.
Right.
So you've got disputes between DNA experts and statisticians about DNA interpretation. And at this point in time, I would say the judge will go with the DNA expert every time.
Interesting.
But that should change.
Stay tuned for more Skeptically Speaking with Layla Schneps, author of Math on Trial, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. Today we're looking at how math is misapplied and misunderstood in court proceedings with Layla Schneps, mathematician, author, and member of the Bayes in Law Research Consortium, an international team devoted to improving the use of math in criminal trials. You mentioned DNA, and you actually, there's a chapter in your book devoted to a case where mathematics and DNA was sort of one of the prime characters. This was the case about Diana Sylvester and includes what's called the birthday problem.
In that case, it was not the DNA analysis that was at fault in any way. The DNA analysis was fine. The DNA sample was very degraded. normally, if you have a really good quality DNA sample of one person, there's no mistake about the identification. So what happened here is it was a case about a murder that took place in 1972, so a really long time ago when there was no DNA analysis yet. But there was a semen sample. It was a rape murder, very cruel, very young nurse was killed in her own apartment. And there was a semen sample that remained on the body, and DNA was extracted from this quite recently, in fact, just a couple of years ago, in a series of investigations of cold cases. So they dig out the files and they see what samples can be tested and they test them now. And now we have databases of DNA from registered sex offenders. And you can run the DNA of these old cases through, and sometimes you find a match. And if you do, you know you've got the criminal. And if you don't, well, the criminal just isn't in that database. But what happened in this case that made it a bit special was that the semen sample, the DNA was degraded, and you couldn't get a really absolute complete match like you do with good quality DNA. What they got was a partial match. So that they got some DNA that would match about one person in a million, which is not at all, you know, that the full quality sample of DNA will match one person 300 trillion, much more than the population of the whole world.
Right.
So this would match one person in a million. So they ran it through a database of California registered sex offenders, and they did get a match to this. But what you have to now really, really make a good calculation of the probability of whether this guy is the criminal or not, because there's a chance that he's not, because there are more than one person sharing this partial DNA that was found. And both sides made a calculation, and both sides, to my mind, made a calculation that was faulty. The prosecution did not actually make a wrong calculation, but they kept on saying one chance in a million, one chance in a million, sounding like they meant there was one chance in a million that this person could be innocent.
Ah.
They didn't say it, so I don't want to say that they said it, but I know that this is called the prosecutor's fallacy. It happens a lot, and the jury very easily makes this error. This DNA belongs to one person in a million, and this guy has it, so there's one chance in a million that he's innocent. It's not really correct, right?
Right.
But it's very easy to make that error, and it happens a lot. Now, this is one of the problems where it happens less in court because people are more aware of it, but it happens enormously in the papers when you read about criminal cases, how often they use this exact sentence. So, of course, it doesn't mean that. What it means is there are about 300 people in the United States that could share that DNA. And then you can't just stop there. That means that this guy that you found in the database is one person among 300. If you use nothing but the DNA, all you can say is he's got a 1 in 300 chance of being guilty, 299 out of 300 of being innocent. You have to use the other information that you know. For instance, the fact that the database consisted very largely in young people, whereas the crime was committed in 1972.
Right.
And the guy who matched was elderly enough to have committed the crime. And he was white. There was an eyewitness who saw him running away at the time, and she said it was a white man, and this guy was a white man. And there were just a couple of other, very little, but okay, he had brown hair. There were just two or three little pieces of information. Oh yeah, it was also, of course, shown that he was living in the area back in 1972. Whereas the 300 people sharing that DNA, you can expect them to be statistically distributed all over the country. And
right.
In age also. But that's already, you have to use them. You've got to use them to narrow down the possibility, because if you use nothing but the DNA, you can't convict. You can only get that there may be 300 people in the country and he's one of them. That's all you can get. And somebody should make, which we did in our book, but we didn't do it with the precision that you would need in a criminal court. Somebody should do the calculation that we did in the book, but, you know, really using statistics in a very careful way. Using all the known information about this man and putting it together to calculate the probability that he really is the criminal. So what the defense did is they did something that is actually even wronger, which is they said, here you've got somebody who has DNA, the criminal, I mean the actual criminal, not the accused, but the criminal. His DNA matches one person in a million, and you run it through a database of 300,000 people, which is a third of a million. There's one chance in three that you'll find a false match to the wrong person. So they were saying there's one chance in three that he's innocent. And the flaw in this calculation, well, there are two flaws in that calculation. So the first flaw is if you took a third of a million people randomly distributed all over the country, then you could say that you have a one chance in three of finding this DNA. But this was not a database of randomly distributed people all over the country. It was a database of California sex offenders. to which the criminal certainly belonged, since he raped and murdered this girl. So that's a very narrow section of people, and you have to think of the intersection between random people and those who are registered sex offenders, and that narrows it down a lot, right?
Right.
And the other error, they said there's one chance in three of having what they call a random match, meaning a match to some other person who's not the criminal. And they didn't factor in the probability that the murderer of Diana Sylvester was in the database. They acted like he wasn't in the database,
right?
And that a match would be a random match. Instead, there's a quite reasonable probability, you know, you have to look up statistics and be careful with what you're saying, but many sex offenders are repeat offenders, and so there's a significant chance that the person who raped and murdered Diana Sylvester would be in the database. And you have to calculate that so that your match to someone in the database has a certain chance of being a random match, but it also has a certain chance of being to that person. And you have to calculate what that is. So they didn't do any of that. They said there's a one chance in three that he's innocent.
How often are these degraded or partial DNA samples used in court cases?
A lot. A lot. It happens all the time. Degraded are the ones, well, they can be degraded for many reasons, but typically they can be old. And degraded means, it means that instead of identifying people on the usual number of genetic loci, which in America is 13, and that's considered sufficient to completely identify a person. In the case of the Diana Sylvester's murder, there were only 5 or 6 visible genetic loci to analyze. And the other thing that makes DNA analysis very difficult is mixed samples where more than one person has contributed. You have to know that DNA is made of pairs. So every genetic locus has a pair of alleles, which one comes from your father and one from your mother. In each genetic locus, you have two. But when you have many people contributing to one sample, in each genetic locus, you can have several, and you have to pair them properly. And that's what makes it mathematically difficult.
So are more and more lawyers actually consulting with mathematicians, or is this a case of it's so obvious that I don't need one?
Very few lawyers are consulting with mathematicians. Many more lawyers should be consulting with mathematicians. And lawyers, in some of the cases we looked at, had a tendency to call their friends who know mathematics as expert witnesses, you know, colleagues that are law professors teaching a course on statistics, but who are not professional statisticians. I don't think mathematicians are called often enough.
Because it seems, especially with the DNA stuff, it seems like there's so many variables you have to take into account to really understand what the true probabilities are.
Yeah, in the difficult cases. In the easy cases, it's anyone can do it, even a layman. But in the difficult cases, so there's another case in the book, which is the case, the ongoing case now of Amanda Knox. And this is the trial for a murder of a British student called Meredith Kircher. You know about this because it's been in the news lately quite a lot. And this is very interesting. So there, what happened with the DNA sample came from a knife that was believed to be the murder weapon because the DNA of the victim was found on this knife, and the knife was not found where the girl was murdered. It was found in Amanda Knox's boyfriend's home. But the problem with the DNA is that it was a tiny, tiny, tiny quantity, and that's one of the other difficult cases. So you get a graph that looks very much like a DNA graph with peaks, but the peaks are very, very low instead of being quite high and very visible as they usually are. When you have a normal DNA graph, it's called an electropherogram, you can have a bunch of little low peaks that just come from the workings of the machine. And you have to be very careful when you distinguish whether the peaks on the graph you're looking at are the ones from a real person or just background noise from the machine. That's what makes it difficult. So what happened in this case is that the police biologist said, well, every peak is in the same place as where Meredith's are. She had, you know, a reference sample from Meredith herself. And so this is Meredith's DNA, and that's all. She really treated it very simply. The defense of Amanda Knox and her boyfriend firstly pointed out that there was a very large possibility of contamination on such a small quantity, and they were very suspicious of the lab practices, which the police biologist said were fine. And then, okay, they were convicted. They were convicted to 25 years of jail for this murder, and they appealed. And in the appeal, which happened in 2011, the judge called in some independent experts from university. And one of the independent experts was an expert in DNA analysis, and she said that you could not analyze the sample because she used a rule which says peaks below a certain height shouldn't be counted because they are indistinguishable from background noise. And it's true that there's, it's not exactly a rule. Let's say there are guidelines to this effect that are used. That's true. Basically, the whole of the sample would disappear if you used that guideline because all of the peaks were too low. But if you ask statisticians to analyze samples of this kind, they don't do it that way with such a crude rule that just says, well, ignore all the ones that are lower than a certain height. What they do is they will analyze the average height of the background noise over the whole graph, and then these peaks that appear, and then they will give a probability for every peak to be a real human signal rather than just background noise, and they will come up with a probability of a reliability. They will say this sample belongs to the individual with a certain probability. Okay, but that wasn't done because they used DNA experts rather than statisticians. What the independent experts did is they retested the knife. They took a swab, a new one, off the blade of the knife. And then they said, well, there is DNA here, but we're not going to test it because there is, again, it's a small quantity. And you know, these small quantities are unreliable. That's what we already told you about your first one. So there's no point testing it because it's going to be unreliable again. And the prosecution asked that it be retested and said, no, we've got equipment now that can test the small quantity. And the judge ruled against the retest. The judges in Italy have to put out a document where they explain all the reasons for their judgments, which is extremely interesting reading. And what he said was, the first test was not reliable because it was a very small quantity and there was a risk of contamination. We couldn't even be sure the DNA was on the knife at all, as opposed to, you know, floating around in the lab. And now this new test, again, the quantity is very small, so again, it will be unreliable. So what do we gain? We gain nothing. And we found that Coralie and I, when we wrote this chapter, we found that was just a statement that revealed a lot of ignorance about what it means to be unreliable. What should be said is, this result is reliable to within a certain percentage, right? It's like 80% reliable. That means you can be, say, 80% sure that this really comes from Meredith.
Right.
You can put
right.
whatever number you want on it. I'm just saying 80% because the judge said the result is good for purposes of orienting the investigation, but not beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what he said.
Okay.
So I'm just arbitrarily translating his words into the figure of 80%, which is definitely not beyond a reasonable doubt. But if they test it again, and if they were to find Meredith's DNA on the knife again, with a probability of 80%. And if you combine the two tests, your probability that her DNA really was on the knife goes way up. You swab the knife, you test what you've got, it looks like Meredith, but it's a very small quantity, and you're not even 100% sure it was on the knife, it might have been in your machine. So what do? You do it again.
Because it's highly unlikely your machine would show the same background noise on two separate samples.
It's already so ridiculously unlikely that your machine would show Meredith's DNA as background noise that it's outrageous,
right,
to be honest. But okay. It is accepted that these very small quantities are a bit dangerous to work with, and so I understand that it's not completely reliable. So you do it again. And so the judge ruled that they shouldn't do it again, so it wasn't done. And the Supreme Court reversed the acquittal. They annulled the acquittal. They said she has to go back and do a new appeal because that appeal was worthless. And they just put out their document, which explains all the reasoning. It came out just a few days ago. And to my great joy, they said the knife must be retested because this would render the previous result much more reliable if they find Meredith's DNA again.
Yeah, every time they test, it gets more and more reliable if they continue to find her DNA.
Yeah, it's just common. Okay, they could find nothing. Sure, I understand. They could find nothing. Then it's a null test. It doesn't help. But they could also find something that would confirm it. You've got to do the test. And the Supreme Court came down very strongly saying the experts were very wrong not to want to do this test, and the judge was very wrong to accept their suggestions not to do the test.
So we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask, what does the Bayes and Law Research Consortium do? What is your goal?
This is a mathematical theory called Theory of Bayesian Networks that lets you make a kind of a chart, like a little bit like a flow chart of all the evidence you have, and the arrows of influence that one piece of evidence would then cause another piece of evidence to have happened. And you put all the evidence you have in it, and you can actually calculate some probabilities very explicitly. And this is something that will be particularly good when your evidence really is numerical, you know, such as database probabilities and things like that. You have certain pieces of evidence that can be associated with actual numbers.
Right.
And it will let you combine them. And this is something that we saw how to do it and how not to do it in a couple of the cases. But this will do it even if you have quite a large amount of evidence. And combining them can be very difficult. It can be difficult by hand. It can be impossible to do it by hand. And this can be incredibly useful for a lot of cases where we are looking at things like natural numerical facts in the cases, things that are like database frequencies of shoe prints or blood types, DNA types, times taken for certain procedures, all kinds of numerical evidence. And there's a group of mathematicians who are trying to have this reasoning, this kind of reasoning, adopted in court cases. And in fact, what they really would like, ideally, is not that these things are done in court in front of a jury. This would be typically used in the pretrial phase. That is, lawyers should be trained to understand how to use it. And they should understand what the evidence is showing when you combine it. It's really a whole system of how to combine pieces of evidence, each one being sort of separately understood. But how do you put them together? What's their influence on each other? We really believe that this should just become absolutely part of the training in law school. And then lawyers could get a better picture, and certain wild errors would be kept out of the court this way.
Yeah, those red flags would be seen earlier rather than, you know, four appeals down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm maybe even sometimes this kind of thing can be done in front of a jury, but generally speaking, that's probably not even that advisable, because it's hard to expect them to understand this thing done right in front of them. Whereas if it's been done properly beforehand and you've got the expert witnesses and the lawyers agree and everybody agrees, and they come and they present it in court, this numerical information which has been done correctly, then it's fine for the jury to accept it.
Leila, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about Leila Schneps, her work with the Bayesian Law Research Consortium, or her book, Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom, you can visit her website at mathsontrial.blogspot.fr. And that link will be available in our show notes at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Dr. Patrick Ball to discuss his work at the Human Rights Data Analysis Group right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're telling spooky stories about monsters both real and imagined. We'll speak to science writer and blogger Frank Swain about his book, How to Make a Zombie: The Real Life and Death Science of Reanimation and Mind Control. And we're joined by science writer Matt Kaplan to discuss his book, Medusa's Gaze and Vampire's Bite: The Science of Monsters, about the possible real-world inspiration for some of fiction's most enduring creatures. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Dr. Patrick Ball, Executive Director of the Human Rights Data Analysis Group. He has spent more than 20 years conducting quantitative analysis for non-governmental organizations, truth commissions, international criminal tribunals, and United Nations missions in El Salvador, Guatemala, Kosovo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Syria, just to name a few. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So what is the Human Rights Data Analysis Group?
We're a small group of social scientists, computer scientists, demographers, mathematical statisticians, applied statisticians, biostatisticians, and other quantitative analysts who look at mass violence. And our question is, how can we capture information in a rigorous way about mass violence? And then, I think even more importantly, how can we figure out what has not been captured? How can we figure out what has not been observed? The point of that is to understand patterns in violence so that we can illuminate the past for historical memory for the victims, sometimes so that we can help UN missions or other monitoring operations figure out what the problems are and where they need to devote resources. And in some of the best cases, we need to evaluate hypotheses about what has happened in the past as part of criminal prosecutions.
So what kinds of violence and human rights violations do you study?
Primarily, we look at homicide, mass killing. Occasionally, we look at a few other kinds of violations. Forced displacement has been one that we've been able to look at. There's a wide range of violence that is very, very difficult to quantify. And so after a lot of attempts at studying things like torture, detention, sexual violence, we've concluded that those phenomena cannot be quantified in a rigorous and reliable way, and so we don't do it anymore.
Okay, so maybe let's talk about an example. Let's talk about Guatemala, since it's actually come back in the news this year. In the 1980s, there was a coup d'etat led by General Rios Montt, and this led to one of Latin America's most violent wars in modern history. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The war had begun actually in the 70s, and what's ironic about the March 1982 coup that brought General Rios Montt to power is that that coup told the Guatemalan people that they were taking over in order to end the violence, which was already quite substantial by that point. And indeed, the violence in the cities stopped when General Rios took power. So a lot of people in urban areas were like, hey, listen, this guy brought us peace. But what General Rios did is create campaigns, military campaigns, in the countryside that actually killed more people than any of his predecessors. He was recently brought to trial for the events in three municipios, like counties, basically, where the Ixchil people, one of Guatemala's 22 different indigenous communities, the Ixchil people live in these three municipios. And the violence was especially bad in those places. So in General Rios' trial, prosecutors accused him of having committed genocide against the Ixchil people in these three municipios.
And he was convicted of this, I seem to recall.
He was convicted. Judge Flores, Yasmin Flores, and her two judicial companions, there's a it's a three-judge panel, did convict him in May this year of genocide. And that conviction stood for, I think, about 8 or 9 days.
So let's talk about how your group was involved in this particular conviction process. What did you guys do in this particular instance?
The testimony that I presented in the case in April this year culminated work that I started with a number of Guatemalan and international colleagues back in the early 1990s. So this is really the culmination of almost 20 years of effort. But my argument boils down to a very simple observation. If we look at the rate at which people in the Ixchil community were killed by the army, and we compare that rate, essentially the percentage of the people who were killed by the army who were not indigenous, we find that indigenous people were 8 times more likely on a per capita basis to be killed by the army during the government of General Rios relative to non-indigenous people who were their neighbors. So in a formal statistical sense, we conclude that this finding, the finding that indigenous people are 8 times more likely to be killed, is consistent with the prosecution's hypothesis that genocide was committed. So genocide is not a crime that is only about mass killing. It's also about the perpetrator's intention to eliminate a specific group. So if you're going to try to eliminate one group, the implication is you're not going to be trying to eliminate the other group. You're going to be targeting the first group. And targeting means you're avoiding the people who are not targeted.
Right.
So to a statistician, the reasoning here is that we would look for a huge difference in the mortality rate between the targeted group and the non-targeted group. And in fact, we find that huge difference. It's an eightfold difference in that rate. And that's pretty huge. So we conclude that the statistical evidence is consistent with the hypothesis. It's not proof. And we can, if you're curious, we can talk about that. It's actually, there's some complicated reasoning steps in there. But it is a little bit of evidence that adds to our confidence. It's like circumstantial evidence in a normal court case.
I am interested in this, so let's drill down a little bit. How do you figure out who, or in this particular case, which groups are targets of something more one-sided, like a genocide, rather than just sort of unfortunate casualties of a violent situation?
Well, let's unpack. So among the pieces of your question is the question, how do we know who was killed? And the answer is, we had 4 lists of deaths that were collected by different non-government organizations, 2 in the 1990s, one by left-wing NGOs, non-government human rights groups, a second by the Catholic Church. A 3rd list was collected by the Truth Commission in 1997 through 1999. And then a 4th list was collected between about 2006 and 2011 by the National Program to Provide Compensation, a domestic Guatemalan governmental program to provide compensation for victims of the of the conflict. So between these four lists, I can put them all together and deduplicate them and determine which people we know about. We can name with a first name and a last name, and Guatemalans have two first names and two last names, so getting at least one of each, as well as a date and location of death. So I have, and I have a bunch of other information in there too, but those, that's the minimum, including we know the perpetrator.
Right.
From that, we have a list of who's been killed. And we can then do some statistical reasoning to figure out how many people we don't know about who have been killed.
Right, because I'm assuming most of the people who die in situations like this, there are either no witnesses or there's no sort of recording of it. You know, they're sort of anonymous people.
It actually is highly conflict specific. We call that the coverage rate, the rate at which deaths become known to, you know, a project that can write it down and remember it. And the coverage rate varies wildly by conflict. We have a saying in our team that every lawyer killed at high noon in an urban center is known throughout the world by evening, there, you know, and journalists as well. So there's particular categories of people that are almost immediately documented and known throughout the world.
Right.
But then there's other categories of people, you know, in our sort of canonical case is, you know, a peasant killed in a rural area in the middle of the night, 3 days walk from a road. Even if there's a cell tower there, you may never hear about that. People thought that cell phones were going to change everything, and they actually haven't changed things very much. In fact, they've amplified the people we knew about. We hear about it 100 times instead of 5 times, and it doesn't really change the people we didn't hear about the first time very much at all. So it's cell phones have made the problem worse, not better. But nonetheless, we can do some statistics and figure out where the non-documented people are. And, you know, in one presentation I made to a rural group in Colombia, one of the families of the disappeared said, you know, if we can't name them all, at least we should count them. And that's the position that we take. At least we should count them. So we try to figure out how many there are. We account for how many we can't observe directly. And then we look at, we do these sort of experiments, and the thought experiment sounds like, if there had been genocide, what would the mortality rate look like? And that says, well, if there had been genocide, the differential mortality rate between the targets of the genocide and the people who are not targets of the genocide should be very different.
Right.
And then we look at the data and we say, well, indeed, we find that difference. And that allows us to make this conclusion that the evidence is consistent with the hypothesis. Your question was, how can we know whether the pattern we observe is the result of the hypothesis or is the result of some other pattern? And the answer is, we can't. We can't exclude the possibility that there are other hypotheses which would equally well account for the finding we have made. And that difference, our inability to exclude other hypotheses, is the reason for our conclusion that the data are consistent with the original hypothesis, rather than saying that our data are the proof of the hypothesis. It's the job of, in this case, the judges to determine whether the aggregate of all the evidence that's presented to them, much of which is eyewitness evidence, some of which is from forensic anthropologists observing human remains, some of which is statistical, they have to synthesize all of that evidence and make a conclusion, a finding of fact, about whether or not there was genocide.
So I'm interested here in the actual systems you guys use as well. Your website talks quite in depth about something called multiple systems estimation. Can you go a little bit more into what that is and kind of how it works?
Multiple systems estimation is a statistical technique used to figure out how many events you do not observe directly. Statistical reasoning is about 400 years old. It's been around forever and ever. It was first applied to actual populations, looking at animal populations, actually. If you've ever seen a wildlife TV show and the ecologists go out in the wild and they capture and tag a bunch of animals, and then later they come back and they capture other animals and they figure out how many of them have tags. What they're doing in that process is trying to figure out what the size of the whole population is. And they can't observe the whole population for all kinds of reasons. For deaths, when we're looking retrospectively at deaths, if I'm doing a study in 2013 of deaths that occurred in 1983, there can be no new deaths in 1983 because 1983 is over, it's passed. So I have a much simpler problem in some sense than the wildlife people have. But the math And that's, you know, one of the many cool things about math is that once we've developed a mathematical technique for one kind of problem, other kinds of problems which share characteristics or are simpler than the original problem, you know, you can use similar math for. So our math is not exactly the same as for the ecologists, but we can learn a lot from what they've done and derive a similar kind of estimation technique, all focused on this problem of figuring out who we have not seen. The point is not necessarily to figure out the total. So a lot of times people say, well, it's not important how many people were killed. One is too many. And that's right. One person has been killed. That's too many. So why does it matter if we have one or 100 or 1,000 or 100,000? But what does matter a lot is when we try to compare subparts of that total, we need to make sure that those subparts mean the same thing. So let me give you an example. Let's imagine that we want to look at a pattern over time. So we need to know how many people were killed in March and how many people were killed in April. And to do this, we have a team whose job it is to document deaths. So they go out and do their work. So in March, let's say there's five people on the team, and they go out and they work really hard and they document 100 deaths. In April, some of our team go on vacation. And other members of the team, one of them gets sick. And so they, in April, they document 40 cases. Now, if we just looked at the data, it would seem like deaths went down between March and April from 100 to 40.
Ah.
But actually, our documentation team did a lot less work because they had, you know, people on vacation, someone was sick. They were not able to bring as much observation attention to the problem.
Right.
So what happens is that what we have to do right away is just say, hang on, first of all, we probably shouldn't think that 100 deaths in March is accurate either. We know that the 40 in April is probably a very substantial underestimate, but the 100 in March may have been an underestimate too. You know, we should recognize that the number of deaths that are being documented by our process is a function not of how many deaths there are in the world, but how many people we have looking for them. This is a very challenging thing to recognize. Once you realize this, your sense of what's true about the world becomes very fuzzy. Because what you realize is that information about the social world is produced itself by social processes. There's, you know, resources, there's confidence, there's trust, there's competence. All of these things create a social process of information about the social world. So if you want to know what's happening in the social world, you have to figure out in what sense your knowledge of the social world is being mediated by the social process that created the information about it. Now, I'm not criticizing the people who create information at all. They're doing the best they can. I'm criticizing people who read information in naive ways, who think that information is somehow completely true because they've got it from a data set they found on Google. That's very naive.
It sounds like you're sort of saying the context of the data means as much as the data itself.
In some sense, that's right. A statistician would call it the sampling process.
Okay.
The way a statistician would frame this problem is, what is the probability that an event that actually happens in the world turns up in our data? We go back to that notion of capture probability we talked about a couple of minutes ago. As we talked about before, those capture probabilities vary wildly across the social space. So if we think about the process that gets that information, that's a kind of analytic or qualitative way to think about this underlying set of probabilities of knowledge given the events that occurred. So something happens out in the world. Do we know about it? Maybe. So how do we unpack the maybe? We unpack the maybe by saying, what are our tools for learning about it? And what are the probabilities with which any set of tools can figure something out that happened in the world, that can actually document it? And that, in my experience, and I've been thinking about this problem pretty hard since about 1998, it's incredibly complicated. And people who think they know are very, very often really, really wrong, including me. I mean, people who say, you know, I say this to people like, oh, no, I know that the data is really good over here, but it's not so good over there. I know that. Don't worry about it. And then I go and I do the estimates. I'm like, no, actually, it's not like that. That's not actually what we find here. People are really bad at figuring out when they should and shouldn't be confident about knowing something.
And I'm assuming different data sets have different strengths and weaknesses. So when
Absolutely.
You kind of cross-reference them, you kind of get to see the sort of strengths and weaknesses of them all.
The formal term is record linkage. So you're linking records across data sets. You would think so. But unfortunately, I wrote a paper a few years ago in which I showed that if you merge a bunch of data sets together, the statistical patterns in the merged data can be worse than the statistical patterns in some of the original data.
Really?
Where worse is in the context of their statistical proportionality with the real pattern. And the reason that's true is that while every time you add data, necessarily you are covering a greater fraction of the whole, right? That has to be true.
Right.
However, remember the March and April example?
Yes.
What if all the new data you add is only in March? You were already sampling March at a higher rate than you were sampling April. Now you've sampled March at an even higher rate than you sampled April. So the pattern that you got after adding data is worse than the pattern you had before you added data.
Sir, you live in a very complicated field.
Indeed, I do. And see, the thing is, the reason it's really complicated is because it's hard to explain to people who haven't spent 15 years looking at the data. People want to know so badly what's going on in mass political violence that they will resort to any kind of proxy that makes the slightest bit of sense to them, even if it makes no sense at all, technically. People are very eager to mislead themselves, and it happens all the time. and it's disastrous for policy. I mean, I can tell you some stories about policy that is just terribly, terribly wrong based on these naive readings of data.
Just because we're almost out of time here, but what evidence do we have that the multiple systems estimation that you guys do is actually accurate, that it actually reflects real happenings in the world?
Statisticians call that validation, is the way that that's approached. And you want to figure out, even if the math works in a probability sense, does it work when you validate it? And you validate it in a couple different ways. I mean, the best way to validate something is if you actually know the answer before you do a study. And then you see if the study comes up with the same answer that you actually knew in some authoritative way. MSE has done very well in these kinds of validation studies. So we validated the estimates that we get by MSE against estimates that people come up with or that we've come up with by other studies using probability samples, where we do a random household survey. We select randomly households and we go to each household and we ask them, we ask the head of household, tell us about your parents, your siblings, and your children.
Mm-hmm.
When were they born? And if they've died, when, where, and how did they die? And from that analysis, we can figure out patterns of mortality over time and by type of mortality. And we compare that to the kind of estimates that we get from MSE, and they turn out to match really closely. At least they did in East Timor, where we did this study for the Truth Commission 6 or 7 years ago. Another way to do validation, which we've also done, is if you end up with what to a statistician is called a perfect census. What if you get all the data? And you can get all the data, or nearly all. You can get within 2 or 3 or so % of all the data if really very specific circumstances occur. And they're rare. As far as I know, it's only happened twice. But, you know, if you have enough killings, enough killings being, you know, 10,000 or so more. If you have fewer than 10,000, well, you know, okay, you could probably do it. It's not that hard. But if you have 10,000 or 100,000, it's a lot harder.
Right.
And both in Bosnia, looking back at 92 to 95, we have an almost perfect census. And looking at Kosovo now, from 1998 to 2000, we have an almost perfect census on the conflict-related killings in both places. And a colleague of mine from the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia did an MSE on Bosnia and came up with results that are almost identical to the census, this perfect census of killings. So MSE worked in Bosnia, and now we're doing similar kinds of studies for Kosovo, where a Serbian NGO has done really terrific documentation. And we have now, again, a way to validate that the MSE produces the same result as the census. So we have several different ways of looking at this that seem to suggest that MSE is the right tool. MSE has been validated extensively in a lot of other fields, in epidemiology, in wildlife population estimation, and in human demography, and in normal demography, the demography of living people, as well as in the wildlife study. So we have, I think, growing confidence in it. That said, the interest in it, the intellectual interest among academic statisticians is growing very quickly. So we're learning a lot more about how MSE works and how to refine it and get better and better ways to do the estimates.
Patrick, thank you so much for being here and for doing the work you do.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about Dr. Patrick Ball or the Human Rights Data Analysis Group and their projects, you can visit hrdag.org or their Facebook group. And both of these links will be available in the show notes on our website. While you're visiting our website, why not also visit our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and our Google Plus page, where you can stay up to date on the latest show news and chat with the Skeptically Speaking team. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can download past episodes of the show, subscribe to future episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening to Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.